Welcome to the Immigrant Stories program. I'm your host, Walter Gallagher. The month of January has been one most of us will long remember. The killing of Renee Good and Alex Preddy in Minneapolis by masked U.S. government agents sent by our own Department of Homeland Security. The dragging of citizens from their homes and cars has left us all wondering who will be next. All this disruption of the peace in the name of keeping the peace made me want to talk to my old friend John Goodwin, a career police officer and former director of the police academy at Colorado Mountain College. What would he make of all this? John Goodwin, thanks again for joining me on Immigrant Stories.
You're welcome, Walter.
The last time you were here was in 2020, right after the murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis.
Yeah, Minneapolis.
And today we're here once again to talk about Minneapolis. But before we do that, let's spend a few minutes talking about your career as a peace officer and the reasons why you chose to spend your life trying to keep the peace, as they say.
I was a peace officer in Aspen, Colorado, starting in 1977 and ending there. I ended as the chief there in 1992. So I was there for 15 years, and then I ran a police academy for 7 years. And then I decided, you know, I learned a lot teaching at the police academy and being, you know, exposed to the ideas of other people who I had hired to teach down there. I decided that I wanted to do the work again, not as a police chief, but as a quote unquote regular police officer. And so I went up to Snowmass Village and was a police officer there. And I was there for 7 years. It was the best job I've ever had in my life. It was just a delightful little community, and the alignment of the values of the community with the department and how the department values align with the people who work there. It was almost a straight line. So there was a lot of joy in doing the work every day because you didn't feel conflicted, you know, about what you were doing. What you were doing up in Snowmass Village is what the folks wanted you to do, and it felt good to do it.
What inspired you? You've been keeping the peace or some variation on that for about 40 years.
Okay. You know, I mean, that kind of question involves all sorts of layers, okay? And, you know, I'll start out with, you know, I was raised in a Catholic home, okay? I went to Catholic grade school, Catholic high school, and I went to a Catholic university, which was Loyola. It was before it was Loyola Marymount. It was Loyola. It was just guys. And I always have to bring that up, you know? And it was the Jesuits, okay? And part of the deal, growing up Catholic, there's a sense of service, a sense of community, and a sense of connectedness with the world around you, and having some responsibility for what's going on. And I got that in particular when I went to Loyola from the Jesuits. And so, you know, that got kind of hammered into me. And I can't tell you exactly how I decided to become a police officer, okay? That's kind of a long story on how I ended up here in Colorado. But
tell that long story short.
Okay. I started out as a social worker in L.A. The feds came out with some kind of budget kind of thing for the L.A. County where I was working. I got transferred into a child support unit. And my job was to interview, and it was 99% women who would come in to get public assistance. My job was to find out who the father and children were and track him down and get some money out of the guy.
Okay. Yeah.
And I'm doing this through the Department of Public Social Services there in LA County. And the feds came out with a deal that said, well, if you have law enforcement, in other words, the district attorney, do this function rather than public social services, we'll pay like 95% of the salaries of everybody. And LA County, not being morons, said, hey, we'll do that. And overnight, I was told, if you want a job, you got to apply for a job at the district attorney's office doing the same thing. And I did. I got it. And I looked around and I saw these guys who were making twice what I was making doing exactly what I was doing, but they were called DA investigators, and they were peace officers. And so I called downtown, and I talked to a guy named Lieutenant Diamond. I just imagined him with his feet up on the desk, and he had a cigar in his mouth, you know. And he was in charge of personnel stuff. And I said, how do I do what they're doing? And he said, well, you need either police experience or a degree, and they call it police science back then. And I said, look, I have a four-year degree in sociology from a university. Does that count for anything? He said, no.
Yeah, I have one of those as well. Yeah, it didn't.
Yeah,
it didn't count. Yeah.
Yeah. So I went down to Long Beach City College to get a police science, an AA in police science. Okay. And then I thought, you know what? If I'm going to do that, I'm going to go down to Cal State Long Beach to see if I what the master's program looks like in criminal justice. I got into that program. One night in class at night, the instructor, his name was Al Gurman, and he read a letter that he'd received from a former student of his who was a police officer up in Aspen, Colorado. And this guy was going to come down to Long Beach on vacation to visit his family. They had a couple of openings up in Aspen. If there was anybody in Gurman's class that was interested in talking to this guy, you know, about maybe being a cop up in Aspen. And then he described what the department was like and what the town was like. And this is 1976, okay?
Yeah.
It's not 2026, no. Aspen, okay?
No. A lot changed in that short time.
Yeah, and I said to myself, man, I could do it up there. Because I had applications in with LAPD and LA County Sheriff's Office. And so I talked to him when he came down. And they invited me to come up for an interview. I'll cut this short. I ended up getting a job in Aspen. And after doing it for 15 years there, and I was the chief there for 5, I had accomplished what I had decided I wanted to do. It was time for me to do something else. And I got this job down at Colorado Mountain College, running the police academy down there.
Well, one of the tenets of the police academy was community policing. The last time I talked to you, you made it clear that the police are the community and the community are the police.
The whole idea of how we have decided we want to be together in this thing called a society here in these United States of America up to this point has been based on what we call a social contract. How do we agree to be together?
Okay. Right.
And out of this, in England around 1829, his name was Robert Peel. And he created the London Metropolitan Police Force. And, you know, up to that point, what they had was like night watchmen and guys, you know, going around, lighting all the lamps,
right,
you know, at nighttime and making sure that the town wasn't burning down or whatever, you know. But, you know, crime was because of the Industrial Revolution, people coming in off the farm. Okay, and getting those jobs and living in those hovels that they were living in. There was a lot of social conflict, and crime was rampant, and there's nobody to deal with it. And Robert Peel, who was the interior minister of England at the time, came up with this idea of creating a Metropolitan Police Force in London. The London Metropolitan Police Force was the first organized police force on the planet.
Wow.
And then come jumping over across the pond, you know, you get to New York City in 1849, started the police department there. Boston was next, all along the East Coast, okay? And then interior into Chicago and Cleveland and what have you, starting police departments. And this is before, you know, radios and radar and drones and all this stuff. This is when cops walked around the neighborhood. Problems got solved with the help of the cop in the neighborhood without throwing people in jail to solve the problems. He was part of the community, okay? And what happened there mattered to him and eventually to her because it affected his quality of life. He didn't travel into L.A., you know, from Santa Clarita, you know, 50 miles away to be a cop in L.A. and then go home back to the Santa Clarita every night. OK, he lived there where he worked.
Given that you're a career peacekeeper, peace officer.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering what this situation in Minneapolis looks like to you. What do you see when you look there?
What I see is people dressed up in a uniform that says police on the back.
Right.
Okay. I have been and continue to be a real student of words and what they mean. And the folks who are working for ICE, they are not police. They're a paramilitary organization. One of the principles that Peel put forward, and I'll read it to you, the degree of cooperation of the public that can be secured diminishes proportionally to the necessity of using police for physical force. The more you got to beat on people, the less you're going to get cooperation from the people out there. Okay, it's very simple. I'll read you another one here, and this one's kind of long. Police at all times should maintain a relationship with the public that gives reality to the historic tradition that the police are the public and the public are the police. The police being only members of the public who are paid to give full-time attention to duties which are incumbent on every citizen in the interest of community welfare and existence. Most of the people in this country don't believe in what ICE is doing right now. Okay. And they definitely don't believe in how they're going about doing it.
When you see officers with masks, what does that do to you?
I'll give you an example that is the flip side of that. Okay. When I worked up in Snowmass Village, we had name tags on our shirts that had a first name and a last name. It said John Goodwin on it. On our summer uniforms, which were short sleeve shirts, like polo shirts, okay?
Right.
The name that was on my uniform was John. It didn't even have a last name. You wore sunglasses when you're out there working. Okay, because it's bright. But I had these glasses that baseball players wear them that flip up.
Outfielder's glasses, yeah.
Outfielder's glasses. And so when I would, let's say someone was speeding and I pulled them over, and when I walked up, I'd flip up those sunglasses so I could look somebody in the eye when I was having a conversation with them. And they could look me in the eye. And they handed me their driver's license, and I had their name in front of me. It was only fair for them to know what my name was, because we're in a conversation. We're in a conversation in which I am reminding them. And this, I know this sounds kind of crazy out there, okay? But I'm reminding them of the agreement that they made in the social contract with everybody else in Snowmass Village, that when they're driving a car, that they will drive it at the speed limit. When they got a driver's license, that's what we all agreed that we're going to do, is that we'll drive on the right-hand side of the double yellow line. We'll stop at stop signs. We stop at red lights. We go when it's green. That's the social contract. Right. That's the agreement we made. And my job was just to remind people that that's what they agreed to. Sometimes it meant that they were going to pay a penalty for not having remembered that agreement. But a lot of the times, It was just a solid conversation. It's about how easy it is to pick up speed going down this hill, you know, and to pay a little more attention to that, you know, and just remind them, you know, if we have another conversation like this, it's going to go a little differently. And that's about it. And so in contrast to that, what you see happening in Minneapolis, and it's not just Minneapolis, it's everywhere in the country where these guys are out doing this stuff, okay? Right. You got seven or eight of them jumping somebody, grabbing somebody, throwing them to the ground, using a level of force that is absolutely unnecessary, and hauling them off to a detention facility.
And what does that do to community policing?
There is none. This is infectious.
Well, we've one of the things that Minneapolis has been trying to do is rebuild trust after George Floyd. So they've done a pretty decent job of turning over their police force and training in a different way. And yeah, that way is community policing. But in watching videos, these police officers are having to show up after ICE has come in and created a chaotic situation. And so the officer's in a position trying to figure out how to quell the disturbance when the disturbance was created by ICE agents.
Yeah, and the really unfortunate part of this is that when people think the police, they just think the police.
Yes,
and they think
anybody with a uniform.
And they think we're all the same. In this valley, the Roaring Fork Valley, where I worked and where I live, we were very cognizant of the fact that as a local police officer, I had no authority nor any requirement to enforce federal statutes. It was not my job to enforce immigration laws.
Right.
Now, that's on one level of it. On a higher level of that, the idea that the quality of life in this valley involved the quality of life for every person in this valley. So we wanted women who were victims of domestic violence to feel comfortable calling us to tell us that they were a victim of a crime, no matter who they were, where they came from, what they looked like, what their last name was, what language they spoke, because the quality of life of everybody depended on people being able to not be a victim of a violent crime. And so one of the difficulties was letting people in the Latino community know that we were there for them. Okay.
Right.
Do you think today people are feeling that way?
Well, people aren't going to the doctor. They're not going outside. They're not reporting crimes. They're afraid. In Minneapolis, they have people who are hiding in their houses, and their neighbors are bringing them food and sustenance.
There's a new term that's come into the lexicon of policing in the last few months. It's called a Kavanaugh stop.
Yeah, I just read about that, actually. Explain that.
It's a Kavanaugh stop, and it's based on Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh's interpretation of what is required for a police officer to actually stop somebody and ask them questions. And according to the Constitution, the requirement for the government to intervene into somebody's life is called reasonable suspicion that a crime has been committed or is about to be committed by a person. Okay?
Right.
Okay, so reasonable suspicion. And what Kavanaugh has said is part of reasonable suspicion can be the language that somebody speaks, the color of their skin, where they work.
Their location,
what kind of work they do. And so if I was a citizen of the United States, a Latino, I would be very careful about when I went to Home Depot to buy some lumber, about what time of day I went to do that. And I would also make sure that no matter what time of day I went to Home Depot to buy some lumber, I had every ounce of documentation on me I could have to show that I'm a citizen of the United States. I would take my baby pictures with me. I would take my high school diploma. I would bring a passport. I would bring it. And nevertheless, there have been instances of people who have had that kind of stuff that have been scooped up by ICE and put into detention.
So okay. We've moved the needle. It used to be that you would get in trouble for using any of those four things, whether the person's speaking English, what they look like, where they work, their location. But Kavanaugh stops has moved the needle closer to authoritarianism.
A Kavanaugh stop, it certainly used to be that if I was a federal agent working for immigration, just because somebody looked Latino, I couldn't stop them.
Exactly.
Okay. Kavanaugh says, now you can.
Well, speak a little bit about what you think that's done, not only to policing, but the fabric of our communities. Take Carbondale and the Roaring Fork Valley, for example, dropping ICE and Border Patrol in there to round up people. What would you assume, what have you seen in the way of the change in community?
Well, let me back up just a little bit, okay? Originally, the idea of all of this is that ICE was going to seek out and find verifiable dangerous people
exactly.
in our communities, okay?
That all went away pretty quickly.
I support that, okay? If we have bad folks who shouldn't be here, doing bad things, can get them gone. Okay. That slid off in a heartbeat. You know, what's happening now is kids aren't going to school. People aren't going to the doctor.
Yes.
They're not going to the library. It's a rupture in our community. And all the effort that I made and lots of police officers made over the years to develop solid relationships with people of different cultures in our community. Okay. It's just being ripped up.
Well, not only is it gone for you as a police officer, a peacemaker, but it's also gone for neighbors. People can't depend on neighbors necessarily because they're not sure who turned them in. I think Minneapolis has done a decent job of turning out for their people and ensuring the Latinos of that community that they're there for them. But
And you can do all of that you can put together, okay?
Yeah.
But there's still a feeling of vulnerability on people's parts.
In preparation for our conversation, I watched a lot of video of ICE agents, and I'm reminded of movies that I've watched about the rise of the Third Reich, the scenes in the movies where the guys in the cars drive up and dump out and go into a place and the people they haul away are never seen again. That's something I never thought I'd see in the United States, or I hoped I'd never see.
It's a seeing that you'll never be able to erase.
Right.
I can pretty easily just feel a sense of despair about all of this. It's just, I can get off into...
Yeah, I can get off. I can get off into it myself. That's one of the reasons I called you, because I couldn't imagine the depth of despair for somebody who's devoted their lives to trying to build community in a peaceful way.
Well, you know, if you look at the statutes in the vast majority of states, of the 50 states that we have,
right,
the term that they had for me was peace officer, not police officer, peace officer. Okay, in the state of Colorado, I was a peace officer. In the state of Arizona, they're peace officers. In the state of Utah, they're peace officers. In the state of Texas, they're peace officers. The vast majority of states, we are called peace officers. And I said earlier, I'm a student of words and what words mean. And the idea was that my role was to bring peace to my community, not violence, not fear. And so these folks who are doing this work, they are not peace officers by any stretch of the imagination. They're in the business of creating fear. They want to hire 10,000 more ICE agents in 2026. You know how many people they're supposed to scoop up every day? 3,000 a day.
The police officers that are on duty that now, some of the people that you turned out of the academy that are still on the job.
Yeah.
You think you're despairing. It must be really hard for those people. So it's really frustrating. And in watching some of these videos, you could see the policemen roll up and go, and the people who are standing there who are being abused going, come on, you're supposed to be on our side.
I know.
Yeah. They're calling the cops out going, hey, what about community policing? I know you. Don't let this happen to me.
It's a tough one.
It's a really tough one.
When you've got the Vice President of the United States saying that ICE agents have absolute immunity to do anything they want, when I hear that, well, it's just one thing in a day to hear out of 100 things in a day where you go, where is that coming from? Did these people ever read the Constitution? Are they here in the United States? Did they grow up here? I thought you went to Yale Law School. You should know better than that.
Well, if you, in fact, can do anything you want, it's no wonder they wear masks. It makes it a whole lot easier for them to do those unspeakable things to people.
I was proud of what I did. I wanted people to know who I was. I wanted people, you know, when they're at the barbecue, you know, on July the 4th, and somebody comes up with, starts talking about a ticket they got, okay, I want, you know, somebody who dealt with me as a cop say, hey, slow down here a little bit. You know, they're not all jerks. You know, I ran into this guy, John Goodwin, you know, and, you know, he wrote me a ticket, but, you know, I deserved it. But he was really cool about it, okay, explained everything to me about it and what have you. You know, and you know, those guys up in Snowmass, you'll really get a kick out of this. On their shirts, they just have their first name. Isn't that crazy? But you got to work it. You got to work at this and see that there's value in it.
But when you divorce those folks from the community and you put masks on them, all bets are off. And
they are.
That was John Goodwin, one of the kindest people I know. John and I both agreed that one of the things that gives us hope is the reaction of the people in Minneapolis in this time of trouble. Susan Raffo, a Minneapolis writer, reminds us that what we are witnessing is not exceptional. She says, and I quote, "This is a steadiness of love as caring for your neighbor, love as meeting the material needs of someone nearby. There's nothing new or fancy or romantic about it. It's just love. We've set up grocery food deliveries. We have someone helping with parent authority forms for just in case a parent gets kidnapped and their child is left behind. We also have a lawyer who can file habeas petitions. There are seniors at a nearby assisted living facility who do the laundry for those sheltering in their homes. There are rent funds, funds for bills that sometimes include paying for bonds and legal fees. We have a doctor who can do medical house calls, and we are connected with a group of vets who can help people with their pets. This love is not exceptional. It is the acts of service kind of love, the kind of love that says to your neighbor, let us take care of each other. I'm going to remember you. It's the kind of love that says, this is how we survive, together. But as we look for the helpers in these times of trouble, like Mr. Rogers advised, our Department of Homeland Security is doing the same. It's expanding its efforts to identify Americans who oppose immigration and customs enforcement tactics by sending tech companies legal requests for the names, email addresses, telephone numbers, and other identifying data behind social media accounts that track or criticize the agency. And so it goes.